Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Welcome back to Entrepreneur Architect. This is the weekly podcast where architects learn to build better businesses. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is episode 14. The daughter of an economist, inspired by an advocate St. Louis architect at the age of 15, this week's guest on the Entrepreneur Architect podcast climbed her way up through the profession, making a difference every step of the way. She's an associate at Cambridge 7 Associates, located in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she's the 2014 president of the Boston Society of Architects. She's married to a fellow architect, and she's mom to two kids. Today on the podcast, I am honored to have had a wonderful conversation with a very inspiring woman, architect Emily Grandstaff Rice. We talked about her journey to become an architect, the many influences on her career, her thoughts about young architects entering the profession today, and where she thinks the profession may be 20 years from now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I certainly did. I really think that Emily and I may be kindred spirits. So secure your earbuds. You're not going to want to miss this one. Here's the interview. Emily Grandstaff Rice, welcome to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
It's great to speak with you today. I start every podcast so far with getting the background of my guest so we can kind of understand where you've come from and to tell us a little bit about the story of your journey to arrive to where you are today. So can you do that?
I would be happy to. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, which was a wonderful place to grow up. My parents are not from St. Louis. So there's an interesting existence when your parents aren't from a place, but you become a native of that place. And as a result, I've gone on to live in New York and Boston, but I always consider St. Louis home. And my 7-year-old son likes to really rub that in after the Red Sox won the World Series this year. But that's a slight segue. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I had really wonderful educational opportunities. And one of that was to grow and develop at John Burroughs School, which is a high school in St. Louis. And there was an architect, Eugene Mackey, who every year would spend a day with art students who were interested in architecture. And we would literally get a bus and drive all over the city sketching and asking questions and looking at things. And this got me thinking about this profession. The next step was the summer before my senior year, my father actually asked if I would be interested in doing a pre-college program. And I ended up going to Carnegie Mellon for 6 weeks. And I really struggled between studying art for 6 weeks or architecture. And I ended up choosing architecture, and I'm really glad that I did, because once I had that experience of being in an architecture school, thinking about the environment and more importantly, how I could have a positive impact in that, I was hooked. And so I went into my senior year knowing what I was going to study, which was kind of a little struggle with the guidance counselors, but that was a long time ago. So I... a little more background. So my father is an economist, and he taught me very early on that things can be analyzed through spreadsheets. So I was doing data entry from a very early age sometimes. So the way we picked where we were going to go is that all of the factors from the Princeton Review were entered into a spreadsheet and given weighted importance. And it turned out that, he had gone to Union College, so he encouraged me to apply to RPI, which is Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
That's where Anne-Marie went, my wife.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So I always have to sort of explain it, because in the Midwest, very few people are familiar with it. In the Northeast, it's a different story. Yeah. So I went to I applied to the school that nobody had heard of in my geographic sphere, and they ended up giving me a great offer. And of course, financial was a very heavily weighted feature in my dad's spreadsheet. And I went to RPI, and I had a good experience. I won't say it was a smooth experience, but anyone who goes to architecture school and has a smooth experience is probably not in the right place. I mean, it's designed to challenge you and develop and expand your concept of how you think about things, but more importantly, how you think about the built environment. And I had some fantastic opportunities, and I am the architect I am today because of that experience. I at the time was dating another architect. I am now married to him, and he's from the Northeast, and we had a 5-year plan to move to Boston. I wonder how that's going now that I'm on year 14. I worked for an amazing designer, Adolfo Perez, who's in Newton. We did high-end residential, and I learned a lot from Adolfo, but ultimately it was a small office, so I needed something bigger. And by bigger, I didn't mean sort of scope, but more just people. And I sent out lots and lots of things and landed at Cambridge 7, and I've been here 11 years next week. So it's been an interesting journey. And so when people ask me, why do I work at Cambridge 7? It's because I get to work on projects that I would never get to work on anywhere else. When I was hired in 2003, I started on the Charles Street Jail Hotel conversion into the Liberty Hotel.
Oh, wow.
When can you say that you were working on a county jail to hotel conversion?
Yeah.
And it was just bizarre and amazing and crazy. I mean, the walls are 18 inches thick granite. So talk about, so how do you put finishes on the wall? You can't. I mean, it just doesn't exist today. And so my apologies. That's my office phone.
No problem.
I'll start over again. So it was just one of these opportunities where you got to work on things that you couldn't interrupt elsewhere. I'm sorry, you couldn't listen to me. You couldn't encounter elsewhere. So after that, I've worked on some projects in the Middle East, higher education in Kuwait, and the one project that is probably the most personal to me is the Boston Children's Museum. And I worked on that while I was pregnant with my first child.
Wow.
And I will never forget the moment where I had to go in and I was, you know, I had worked on it through design on the design team, and I was also going to go forward on construction administration. And I had to sit down with the client and the owner's project manager and the construction supervisor and basically tell them all that I was pregnant and at some point I would have to step away and then eventually come back. And I love the owner's reaction, because I told him and he turned to me and he goes, "That's great. One more customer." this is the type of client that I want to work with. And I love what I do. I love that it makes a difference. I love that it's wacky. I love that I just have these assignments that when do you have to investigate whether the bird deterrent system will counteract with the snake that happens to be in a discovery room? I mean, just bizarre encounters that make what I do fun.
Yeah, I could hear the passion in your voice for what you do. I want to just go back to what you said in the very beginning of your story, with the architect Eugene Mackey in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And the influence he had on you. At what age was that when you first discovered that?
I met him at 15. And so I ended up going on three of his trips. So at age 15, 16, and 17. And Gene Mackey is the owner of Mackey Mitchell Associates in St. Louis, Missouri. And his commitment to not only reaching out to young architects, but mentoring them within his own office is really a fantastic example. And not only did he come to the high school, but he left the door open and basically said, "If you have any questions about architecture, let me be a resource and, you know, come to my office." And so when I applied to school, I actually contacted him and had him look at my portfolio. And he showed me around the office. And I even went back to check in, really, after my second year at RPI. And so he was always willing to take an appointment with me and talk. And one of my favorite moments was in 2008, when the Boston Convention was here, or sorry, the AIA Convention was here in Boston. I had helped the Chancellor of Fellows, Carol Olshofsky, do a legacy project for the College of Fellows, where we had gone out and instead of spending money for centerpieces at the large Fellows dinner, we spent that money towards having K-12 workshops and teaching kids, or not necessarily teaching them, but really having them do a project exploring if they could build some type of civic architecture in Boston, what would it look like? And having that discussion. And so the money went towards materials, and then their creations were then displayed as the centerpieces for the 88 tables that were at this very large dinner.
Yeah.
And Carol had invited me to the dinner because of my involvement with the centerpieces. And it was the same night that Eugene Mackey was being honored for commitment to the profession and his sketches by the fellows. And so we had this great moment where, years after I had met him as a teenager, I then got to meet him as a professional colleague. And that was very rewarding for me.
Yeah.
And there have been other architects who have opened their doors to me and been able to show me around their office or just have a conversation. And I love that this profession is about connection. And because it's based on the apprenticeship model, we all know what it was like to have a mentor. The Young Architects Forum had a chat yesterday, and one of the questions was, how important do you think mentoring is? And unfortunately, I sort of sent back a very quick sarcastic response, and I said, you know, what kind of question is that? We all have mentors. Architecture cannot be taught in a book.
Right.
It's not a self-study profession. You have to interact with others. Even if it's not under the direct supervision of an architect, you have clients, you have stakeholders, you have community, you have people. It's a team sport. So I in turn have just met a lot of people calling me up and asking if, you know, we can meet for coffee or other stuff like that. And it's a people oriented profession.
Yeah.
I like that.
I love that story. And our profession obviously is going through a pretty dramatic transition right now. We're trying to figure out, you know, who we are and where we're going and what we stand for as a profession and whether we'll even be here in 25, 30 years. My feeling is that things like Gene Mackey and the things that you've done with the kids, with those centerpieces, those actions are the actions that are going to save the profession of architecture and allow it to grow into something that's more, influential in our society beyond what it really is today. Because we need to have the general public, the everyday person, understand what we do and the importance of architecture and those small things. I mean, just imagine how many people Gene Mackey has influenced and not just to become architects, but just general public respecting architecture and understanding the importance of it.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And this reminds me of one of the issues that I hear over and over again within the AIA or the profession in general, which is, you know, we're losing so many architects to other professions. And I think we need to look at the other side of the coin, which is we're gaining so many more informed clients and advocates.
Right.
And it's not about doing it the way that we've always done it. We need supporters in all different realms. And we don't all need to be architects in a traditional sense. I mean, some of us still need to do that because right. That's important.
Yeah.
But yeah, just simple outreach or reaching out and making a positive memory so that you've built a bridge for the future.
Right. Right. And you're doing something about that in 2000, you know, you've just become the 2014 president of the Boston Society of Architects. Tell me a little bit about what led you to become active in the profession to that level and how you got there and some of the ideas that you have for that position.
Yeah. So this is also one of those interesting stories about connections. I applied for the BSA, the Boston Society of Architects, Young Designers Professional Development Institute, when I came to Cambridge 7. And it's a year-long program with different focus topics, and mostly around soft skills. And so the idea is that you teach and refine soft skills early in one's career, and so that when they develop into more responsibility, they have a good foundation to build upon and to grow with those skills. So one topic would be about speaking. One would be about writing. One would be about project management and budgets. Another would be about construction administration, et cetera, et cetera. And it's run by Bill Ronco, who's an organizational consultant here in Boston. And so that was a great experience, and I was so jazzed by that experience. I thought, well, what's one of the ways that I can give back to, after having this experience? And I nominated it for what was at the time the AIA Emerging Professionals Program of the Year Award, something like that. Well, it won. Yeah. And the brilliance of the BSA at the time was saying, okay, she took this initiative and she did this. Let's send her to the convention in Chicago to get the reward. So they sent me to convention, which was wild and a lot of fun. And that is a case of sort of building on one's intrinsic motivation and enthusiasm and making space for them to have opportunities with more opportunities within that organization. And I then decided that I would like to get more involved in the Young Architects at the BSA, and which led to getting on the membership committee. And another example of recognizing interest and supporting that is one of my current and former and future and all of the above mentors, which is Peter Kuttner here at Cambridge 7. And Cambridge 7 is about a 50-person firm, but we have had three BSA past presidents. And one day Peter Kuttner sat me down and said, oh, okay, I know that you have interest in the BSA, and I think that you would be a good president one day. So I just want to give you the history of the BSA and help you track a way to perhaps seek this if you want it. And he says, you know, Terry Rankin was president in 78. Chuck Redman was president in 88. I was president in 98. And he goes, unfortunately, we dropped the ball in 08.
So catch up.
Yeah, catch up. And so he said, well, I think we should think about, you know, you developing into this role in 2018. And I was kind of taken aback because it wasn't something that I had thought about actively. But we talked about it, and not that it was predetermined by any means. No. Right. But it was one of those moments of somebody seeing something in me that I hadn't seen yet.
Yeah.
And this was around 2008, and so I think that might have been part of it as well. So he sort of said, you know, these are ways that you can get involved in the BSA and think about running for the board and all this other stuff. And so I was so jazzed by this that I considered running for the board, and I got in on my first election. So I started on the BSA board in 2009, and then after 2 years, I ran for another term. So that got me to 2011, 2012, and I sort of said, I serve a unique demographic on the BSA board because there aren't that many people under 40 on the board, and I felt like I had a responsibility to continue that representation. We talk a lot about the demographic cliff, that there aren't as many Generation X and Y architects as there are baby boomer architects, and that for us to be sustainable as an organization, we need to expand our idea of what a member is. There will not be a one-for-one as architect licensed members in 20 years. It's just not going to happen. The numbers aren't there. You look at the number of baby boomers retiring. You look at the number of licensed architects coming up in age. And I've been talking about this for a lot of years on the BSA board. I felt that it was important to continue that conversation. But also personally, I have two kids, and I want to be a model for others to be involved in the BSA, even with young children, because I think that it is possible, and I'm not saying that it's right for everybody, but I don't want anyone to say, I can't do it because I have these other responsibilities,
right,
because they're mutually exclusive. That's not the case. And if anything, it's more of a, I can do it. Well, one, because I have an incredibly supportive husband who's also an architect here in Boston. But because I also have the passion. And I think that's a that's a secondary concern of mine, to pave the way for others to do it, because I think younger voices, more diverse voices, only help to enhance the conversation.
Yeah, that's very inspiring. I find that leadership and getting involved in the profession, actually getting involved in anything really, but especially the profession, it's almost addictive. That once you start and you kind of get a feel for it and you see the influence you can have on people and the positive things that can happen from it, you almost can't stop and you just keep pushing it and going with it, which is exactly what's happened with Entrepreneur Architect. I started this as a little thing for myself just to keep records of business topics, and it's grown into something much bigger, and my plans are to make it huge. So it just keeps growing on itself. Once you reach one level, you say, well, I can go there. And then you see that, and it's almost like you can't really see into the vista until you climb up to that next level, and then you can see that next level, and then, oh, I got to get to that next level, see what's at the next level. And it just keeps growing. And so it's if anybody's listening who has any thought of that, of wanting to get involved, just do it. Just start somewhere. Just go to a meeting and listen, and then volunteer, and then it grows from there, and it just keeps growing and growing. And if enough people do that, then we have a whole massive group of leaders who are ready to make sure that architecture moves in the right direction.
We have a critical force. Yeah. And I am particularly interested in looking at how we will practice 30 years from now, because I think the work that you do is critically important in defining ways in which we organize ourselves as professionals. I believe that Generation X and Y have an entrepreneurial streak in them from sheer it's survival.
Necessity.
Necessity. But also because there are so many things that are changing. I mean, Social Security is one of those ones, right? Ask Generation X and Y how much they believe Social Security will really be there when we need it. I mean, we're completely skeptical because we've seen the buildup of social formations and then the breakdown of them as well. And as a result, we have to be optimistic, because if we're not optimistic, why are we in this profession? But we've got varied interest. I mean, look at Etsy and Pinterest and all these other things. The explosion of communication has allowed people to get in the game in a much different way. And this idea of small, mid-sized, big firms, I think that's going to explode over the next 30 years. So let's get our stuff together and figure out how can we be on top of these trends rather than reactive and always saying, well, that's how it was. And we need to look at this in terms of legal agreements and copyright. We need to look at it in terms of technology. And sometimes technology planning is just visioning, right? Because you really can't plan for the next big thing. We need to look at it in terms of relationships with our consultants, our stakeholders, et cetera, but also how architects organize themselves. You know, what does the firm of the future look like?
Yeah.
And it's so easy to communicate with someone across the globe in different time zones. Will we be collaborating? Well, we are collaborating with them now, but how will that take shape in the future? And I joke at BSA board meetings when we have sort of this critical future visioning things going on, like, you know, should we sign this lease for 20 years or 30 years or and I look around the table and they're kind of getting sick of me making this joke. I look around the table, I go, I'm the only one who's still going to be here in 30 years.
Right. You're the only one that should really have a say in any of that.
Well, no, I'm not necessarily.
No, I'm joking. Yeah.
But you know, I do drive it home that this is incredibly personal to me, because I am working towards ensuring that I have a profession to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. And in 20 years, our profession will be so different than what it is today. And we can't even imagine what it will be.
Yeah. But also imagine how different it was 20 years ago. Yeah. I mean, I'll never forget my first real paying job in St. Louis. I worked for Tom Schwede and Adrian Lucchini. And Adrian Lucchini sat me down. He's a professor at Washington University. He sat me down with the Ching book and said, you need to learn how to write. And that was one of my assignments, is that I had to learn how to letter. I consider myself incredibly important because I was at this bridge moment in time where when I entered, people were still doing a lot of stuff by hand, right, or very archaic CAD. And now look at it today. And I consider it a privilege because I think we as advocates can help to make that transition greater and with more impact.
Yeah. You know, I love that you brought up, you know, what the profession would look like in 20, 30 years, because that's what was one of my questions. So we've covered that. We're definitely on the same page from what we're doing and where we want to go. With you becoming the president, the reason I reached out to you, because I saw on Twitter, your campaign architecture does matter. Could you talk about that a little bit? What inspired that, and what's your ultimate goal for that?
Yeah, well, I was flying home to St. Louis in early November for a family event. And as you know, the TSA has recently changed the whole thing about electronic devices on planes. But somehow that memo didn't get to Southwest Airlines. So I was really frustrated at like 6 or 7 in the morning because I just wanted to read a book on my Kindle. And they weren't going to let me do that until we hit 10,000 feet. So, you know, I don't know what I was doing. So I pull out the Airplane magazine, and on the cover was Alex Sheen, who has started a nonprofit foundation called Because I Said I Would. And it was a way for him to connect to his father, who had recently passed away due to cancer. And what he wanted to honor about his father was that he valued staying true to your word. And so he was very big on, if you say you do it, you do it. And Alex had started this campaign with business cards, and they literally just said, because I said I would. And I thought, that's a beautifully simple, amazing idea.
Yeah.
And then I sort of grabbed out my notebook and said, oh, geez, I really need to plan for the BSA annual meeting. And I just thought, what if I did something like that? And I'm fully cognizant that this is a ripoff of Alex's initiative, and I give him complete credit. But one of the things that I did was I then printed up business cards that said, apologize if that phone call came through. I thought that, you know, architects could start talking a little bit more about architecture in the way that Alex was able to get people to talk a little bit more about the promises that they make. And architecture is experienced by everybody and experienced in many different ways, but it's also experienced in small moments. And I did it kind of on a whim and did a soft launch at the BSA annual meeting.
Yep.
And handed cards out to everybody. It's been really fun to see the response. But also, it's almost like a daily meditation for me to think about, what am I going to say about why the profession that I am in matters.
Yeah.
And I try and save my comment to something that happens to me daily. Like, I don't plan them out, mm-hmm. which is good and bad. But it's been a way for me to notice the small things that I didn't notice before. And I'm handing them out to anybody I encounter in the profession. I'm currently carrying this 500 count box in my bag. And I sent you some this week.
I did, yep. And I actually posted some, actually one last night, and went out again this morning.
Excellent. Yeah. No, it's really to just to create that moment where someone is expressing the importance and the passion about architecture. I love the idea. And I don't know what it will be, but for me personally, it's a reminder for me every day to step back and reflect on why does architecture matter? Not just to me, but for the bigger picture. So.
I understand the goal of it is to kind of expose architecture and the importance of architecture. Is there a way for other architects, if they don't get your business cards, is there another way for architects to get involved and kind of help this grow?
Absolutely. I think you don't need a card to do it.
Right.
it's really just a thought. I have an active Twitter feed. It's at ARC. One, because ARC does matter, because I didn't want to spell out architecture. So it's ARCHDOESMATTER on Twitter. And I am also in the process of building a website. And what I want to do is I will put a link to a PDF thing that you can print out. I think that's probably the first step, so that if you do want to have the official card, you can print your own and do it. But I got a great one yesterday, which was at the Abu Dhabi airport, and it was looking at the air control tower by SOM, and the comment was, a control tower, something that's typically ordinary, can be extraordinary because architecture does matter. And, yeah. And I thought that, what a beautiful moment, just to say, you know, that's something that they consciously thought about making beautiful and expressive. And it does change the experience of entering that airport.
Yeah, I love the campaign. I saw one the other day that was pointing at an historic, I guess it was a firehouse or something in the background. And it said, I think I saved this building because architecture does matter. And it was like a brick building in the background. It was really cool. And it's so quick to the point, but it's so clear in what you're trying to achieve with it. And very shareable, very perfect for our current society and how it can be spread very quickly.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And that's really what it's meant to be, is just fun and to create these moments of reflection and really show the passion of what we do. Yeah. Because I think that is going forward, if we are going to talk about our relevance in society, we need to be relevant. and creating moments like this makes us relevant because we highlight why it matters.
Yeah. Do you have some, I'm sure you do. What are some of your own personal long-term goals? Like, you talked about where you want the profession to go and where we think the profession may go. Do you have, beyond the president of the BSA, what's sort of your five-year plan?
My five-year plan, well, I'll tell you my one-year plan, which is to get through this.
Well, you've done a great job already, so I'm sure the rest of the will be fantastic.
Thank you. I mean, in Boston, I've been joking, day 13.
Yeah,
talk
right.
to me on day 20. But one is to, my short-term plan, obviously, to have the greatest effect that I can as BSA president. And by effect, I don't mean sort of big sweeping moves, but these moments of connection and building a bridge for the next generation to come in and be viable in these organizations and really take a lead. I think I personally want to get more involved in advocacy and expressing these in our cities and making larger urban changes. I think that's important. And as I've mentioned, I have two kids, and I have also been working on some initiatives of asking the question of how can we get exposure in K through 12 schools, not unlike how Eugene Mackey used to reach out.
Right.
And I can't do it all. There's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
So one of the proposals I had worked on previously was this concept of having online training for architects. And architects are great architects, but they're not necessarily great teachers. And looking at how architects can be influential in developing STEM, science, technology, yeah, engineering, mathematics, educational skills in the K through 12 as a supplement. You know, teachers have so many things to do, and sometimes some very strict and tight curricula requirements. So wouldn't it be great that as a supplement to that, you could then have an architect come in and talk about reflectively how this actually is applied in the world. So it was an idea that if you arm others with this knowledge and to do outreach to their children's teacher or et cetera, and ways that they can be involved, then, you know, that in itself could grow on its own. So, you know, I think other programs have looked at a train the teacher model, and I think we need to arm architects as advocates themselves to start talking about that, because if we're going to tackle the issue of diversity within the profession, we need to look at children today and allowing them to have an opportunity to think, yeah, architecture is a profession that I can go into. And you and I had talked a little bit about sort of that age in which you discover when you're an architect.
Right.
I think for me, it built up. So I was very involved in building and manipulative stuff as a child. I was very involved in art and mathematics and all this other stuff. But it wasn't until I had that encounter with Gene Mackey that it really sort of snapped. I said, yeah, that's what I could do, right? So I think there were many small moves,
yeah,
but that was the spark that really got the concept in my mind that I could do this as a profession. And if kids don't choose it, then they'll be great clients.
Right.
So the bigger issue. So those are some things that I'd like to do. And you know, those are side things. At Cambridge 7, I'm starting work on an aquarium job in Virginia, which is going to be a long-term project. So that's sort of my professional aspirations is making that job be really successful, because that's the Virginia Aquarium is a great organization, and I'd love to be a part of that.
Yeah. Where is that located?
Virginia Beach.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a bad place to go on a snowy day like this in Boston.
I love the aquariums that your firm has designed in the past. So I'm excited to see yours.
Thank you. Yeah. My poor kids, every vacation we take involves a trip to an aquarium.
Yeah.
But
of being a child of an architect, especially the architect couple, I can relate to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's good. It's good.
Great. Thank you very much for speaking with me and taking the time out to be on the podcast today.
Oh, this is quite an honor. And I fully support the work that you're doing. And I think it's essential to defining how we want to practice and, more importantly, being successful at it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You know, I one of the things that you talked about your kids, and, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I don't talk about it very much, but when you ask architects whether they want their kids to be architects, I don't think I've met too many who say yes. Mm. And I want to change that. I want the architecture profession to be a profession that architects want their kids to become. I think general public people see architects and kind of admire them and respect them, and, you know, they all have the fantasy that, oh, I always wanted to be an architect, but I did something else instead. I want architects to feel that same way, and I think what you're doing is helping that happen, and inspiring me to continue to do what I'm doing. So thanks for doing that.
What a great, great sentiment. My son said to me last night, he wants to be a sculpturist. So I'll now reframe that into, we can make him an architect.
Yeah, that's what architects are, right? That's exactly right.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, is there a specific place that you'd prefer people who are listening to contact you? Is it Twitter or, I mean, you have a great website as well. So I encourage people to go there. I'll put the domain on the show notes. But is there a place that you'd like people to reach out to you?
Yeah, I will have a contact on architecturedoesmatter.org. But of course, Arch Does Matter as a Twitter handle is probably the best way to get to me. And my own personal one is EGRAIA.
Okay, great. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Have a great day.
You too.
I invited Emily Grandstaff Rice onto the podcast because architecture does matter, and Emily's making a difference in this profession. She's a leader that we're going to want to watch as she grows and she builds upon the many exciting initiatives that she's launched at the BSA. She's an influential force in this profession. I know this episode was packed with lots of information. If you've missed anything, you're welcome to go to the show notes at entrearchitect.com/episode14. And I'll have all the links there for you at entrearchitect.com/episode14. If you're interested in getting deeper into learning about business success in architecture, and you want to connect and engage with enthusiastic, like-minded entrepreneur architects, then you're going to love Entrepreneur Architect Academy. Entrepreneur Architect Academy is a multi-session online education program designed and built for sole proprietors, small firm architects, and architecture students. We'll get deep into how to launch and run a successful architecture firm, how to integrate your firm with your family, and how to profitably pursue your passion for architecture. Entrepreneur Architect Academy is coming soon. If you're interested, stop what you're doing right now and go sign up for the pre-launch list at entrearchitect.com/courses. Space is limited, and that list will receive first notice when the Academy is launched. There will also be super secret discounted early bird pre-launch pricing offered to members of just that list. So go sign up today at entrearchitect.com/courses. Don't miss out. This program may just change your life. So that's a wrap for episode 14. Tune in again next week for the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. Until then, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thank you for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay. We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.